Today, we're taking a deep dive into the life of a figure whose image is, well, instantly recognizable, etched into the very fabric of American history. Abraham Lincoln. He's the man on the penny, the face on the $5 bill, just this towering figure synonymous with American ideals.
Right.
Yet his journey from a humble birth, you know, a log cabin, to the presidency, leading a nation through its greatest crisis, it's filled with unexpected turns, profound personal struggles, and unparalleled leadership.
It really is.
We're going beyond those familiar images to truly understand the man. Okay, let's unpack this.
Exactly. Our mission in this deep dive isn't just to recount the historical timeline you might find in a textbook. Instead, we're going to explore the pivotal moments, the personal heartbreaks, and the profound political and philosophical shifts that really defined the 16th president of the United States.
Yeah.
We'll try to extract those crucial nuggets of knowledge, giving you maybe a shortcut to being well-informed about the man who preserved the Union and played, let's be clear, a major role in abolishing slavery.
Absolutely crucial.
Get ready for some surprising facts and maybe some truly insightful aha moments that hopefully will make you feel like you've gained a deeper understanding of his remarkable and often quite tragic story.
Let's begin at the very beginning. Really set the stage for this incredible life. Abraham Lincoln was born on February 12, 1809, in a log cabin on Sinking Spring Farm near Hodgenville, Kentucky. And this wasn't just humble, this was genuine poverty on the raw, untamed American frontier.
That's right. It's quite a stark contrast to the bronze statues and marble memorials that mark his ultimate destiny, isn't it?
It really is.
And the environment Lincoln was born into, it had an immediate and profound impact on his early life. His father, Thomas Lincoln, was a farmer and carpenter who grappled fiercely with land titles.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, losing hundreds of acres in various legal disputes.
Yeah.
This constant instability ultimately led the family to pack up and move to Indiana in 1816, seeking more reliable land, settling in the rugged little Pigeon Creek community.
So always searching for stability.
Exactly. And what's often overlooked, but quite significant, is that Thomas and Nancy, Lincoln's parents, were devout members of a separate Baptist church.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, this was a particularly fervent evangelical group.
Yeah.
And their emphasis on individual conscience often led them to challenge established social norms, including, and this is crucial for Lincoln's family, the institution of slavery.
So that opposition was there early on.
It was a quiet but deeply held family conviction. It subtly set an early tone for Lincoln's future beliefs regarding human liberty.
Beyond the economic struggles, Lincoln experienced profound personal loss very early on, something that would undoubtedly shape his character.
Tragically, yes.
His mother, Nancy Lincoln, died from what was called milk sickness when he was just 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine the immense impact on a child leaving his 11-year-old sister, Sarah, effectively in charge of the entire household at such a tender age? It's just a weight few children would ever bear.
It's almost unimaginable. And sadly, the tragedies continued to mount, casting a long shadow over his youth. 10 years later, his sister Sarah also died in childbirth.
Oh, no.
Yeah. These early successive experiences with death and hardship, coupled with the family's constant struggle for economic stability and a secure home, profoundly shaped his character. It forged within him a deep sense of resilience, an unwavering determination, and perhaps most importantly, a profound empathy for the struggles and suffering of others.
Qualities that would define his leadership later.
Absolutely. Qualities that would define his leadership. His father, Thomas, despite his struggles, was quite industrious, working as a farmer, cabinet maker, carpenter, at various times owning farms, livestock, town lots, even appraising estates.
So he worked hard.
He did. But the specter of hardship was never far, you know. These early experiences truly grounded Lincoln in the harsh realities of frontier life and the fragility of existence.
Despite these immense hardships and the constant need for manual labor, Lincoln was a relentless learner. That's always struck me.
It's remarkable.
He was largely self-educated, attending school for less than 12 months total by the age of 15.
Think about that. Less than a year.
Yet he devoured books, reading everything he could get his hands on, often by firelight. So how did this unconventional path influence his intellectual development and, you know, his unique style of thinking?
Well, this really raises an important question. How did a lack of formal schooling actually contribute to his unique intellectual style?
Right.
Instead of maybe rote memorization, he became an avid self-directed reader, retaining a lifelong, almost insatiable interest in learning. This was truly remarkable for his time and background.
Just pure curiosity driving him.
Exactly. This self-driven pursuit of knowledge enabled him to read law on his own later in life, borrowing hefty legal texts like Blackstone's Commentaries and Chitty's Pleadings from an attorney, John Todd Stewart.
Which wasn't the usual way back then.
No, not at all. Most aspiring lawyers clerked in an established attorney's office. It speaks volumes about his immense discipline, his analytical mind, and his profound intellectual curiosity.
Yeah.
It's also worth highlighting that during his teenage years, his father relied heavily on him for strenuous farm work and income, often hiring him out to area farmers and pocketing his earnings.
Which was common then, but still.
Right. It was customary, but it likely fueled his drive for independence and self-improvement later on.
And what about his early exposure to the very issue that would ultimately define his presidency? He took a flatboat trip down to New Orleans, right?
Yes, he did.
And he observed slave markets firsthand. That must have left an indelible, chilling impression, shaping his views on slavery long before he ever entered national politics.
Absolutely. The historian Michael Burlingame notes this experience would leave an indelible impression on him. It was the first time, but not the last, that he would be repelled while observing slavery firsthand.
So not just an abstract idea for him.
No, this was an abstract theory. It was a vivid, personal encounter with the brutal realities of human bondage. Connecting this to the bigger picture, it highlights how early personal observations, combined with his family's quiet opposition to slavery, deeply influenced his growing moral repulsion to the institution long before he became a political leader. From these early experiences of hardship, self-education, and moral awakening, Lincoln embarked on his own, moving to New Salem, Illinois. That move marks the beginning of his independent life and, soon after, his public career.
Moving from his public emergence, Lincoln's personal life was also just a roller coaster of emotions, filled with both love and profound loss. There's the debated romance with Anne Rutledge, her tragic death,
right,
and his subsequent deep depression, this melancholy, as they called it, seems to have been a recurring struggle for him.
The death of Anne Rutledge from typhoid fever in 1835 hit Lincoln very hard. It sank him into a serious depression.
Really serious.
Yeah, he even contemplated suicide during this period. Friends actually had to remove knives and razors from his vicinity. They were so concerned.
Wow.
This melancholy, as it was termed then, is now widely considered by historians and medical experts to be clinical depression. And it was a recurring theme in his life, particularly after the deaths of his children later on.
Yeah.
While historians still debate the exact depth of his romantic relationship with Rutledge, there's no doubt her passing had a significant destabilizing impact on him.
And there is another engagement.
Yes. Later, he had an engagement to a Mary Owens, which they both eventually decided against. These early experiences with profound personal grief arguably granted him a unique, almost spiritual capacity to understand and articulate the immense grief and suffering of a divided nation later in his life.
That makes sense.
It allowed him to connect with the very soul of America in its darkest hour, perhaps.
His marriage to Mary Todd Lincoln was famously turbulent, wasn't it? Full of its own unique challenges and sorrows that maybe compounded his internal struggles.
It was indeed. A relationship marked by both deep affection, apparently, and considerable strain. Mary was described by contemporaries as, well, verbally abusive and sometimes even physically violent towards her husband. They had four sons, but only Robert Todd Lincoln, born in 1843, lived to maturity.
Only one out of four.
Yes. The deaths of Edward Eddie Baker Lincoln, who likely died of tuberculosis in 1850 at age four, and especially Willie Lincoln. Willie died of a fever in the White House in February 1862, right in the middle of the war during his presidency.
Oh, devastating.
It had profound and devastating effects on both parents. These losses exacerbated Lincoln's melancholy and further deepened Mary's emotional instability.
Understandably.
Their youngest son, Thomas, affectionately known as Tad, born in 1853, also died young at age 18 in 1871 from edema, years after his father's assassination.
So much loss.
Yeah. Lincoln loved children deeply and, by all accounts, was not considered strict with his own. These repeated personal tragedies undeniably added layers to his already complex character, deepening his capacity for sorrow, resilience, and empathy. He carried the grief of his family alongside the burden of the nation. Hashtag tag two to Wes. The prairie lawyer and budding politician, 1831 to 1854.
After striking out on his own and leaving his family home, Lincoln didn't immediately become a lawyer or politician. He wore many different hats, right? Trying to find his footing.
That's right. He worked at a general store. He served as postmaster.
Postmaster, okay.
Yeah, and he even famously won a wrestling match against some local ruffians, as they were called.
A wrestling match?
Yep. These must have been truly formative experiences for a young man trying to find his way in a new town like New Salem.
So really connecting with the community.
Exactly. What's fascinating here is how these early experiences in New Salem, Illinois, were less about career building and more about community building. They allowed him to connect with common people, observe human nature, and really hone his formidable communication skills.
Which are essential for politics.
Absolutely. Essential for any aspiring politician. He gained a reputation for both physical strength and moral courage, qualities that would serve him well. While he lost his first election for the Illinois House of Representatives in 1832, he quickly learned the ropes of campaigning and public life, showed a remarkable ability to rebound from defeat.
He also served in the military briefly.
Yeah, a brief stint as a captain in the Illinois militia during the Black Hawk War. This was a concept involving Native American tribes and settlers over land in Illinois and Wisconsin. He didn't see combat, but it gave him a taste of military organization and the dynamics of frontier conflict.
And the general store didn't work out.
No, his attempt to open a general store with William Barry struggled because, as the historian Michael Burlingame notes, Lincoln was too soft-hearted to deny anyone credit.
Ah, bad for business.
Right, led to the business accumulating debt.
Hmm.
But these early vocations, though not all successful, were crucial in building his local reputation, understanding the daily lives of his constituents, and preparing him for a public life.
It was this sharp legal mind, honed in the courtrooms of Illinois, that he then brought to the rough-and-tumble world of state politics. He became a self-taught lawyer, admitted to the Illinois bar on September 9, 1836.
Right.
And by 1844, he was practicing with William Herndon. He handled, as one historian put it, virtually every kind of business that could come before a prairie lawyer. So what does this truly tell us about his legal acumen and how this period shaped his broader intellect?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, his legal career wasn't just about earning a living. It was his intellectual training ground. It was a profound period of self-development where he sharpened his logic, his rhetoric, and his understanding of human nature.
He argued a lot of cases.
An extraordinary number. He appeared before the Illinois Supreme Court in 411 cases throughout his career, which gives you a sense of his workload and dedication. His legal practice was broad, dealing with many transportation cases amidst the nation's westward expansion, particularly river barge conflicts involving the new railroad bridges, a cutting-edge issue back then.
Yeah, the clash of old and new technology.
Exactly. And in a truly unique twist, he even received a patent in 1849 for a flotation device designed to lift riverboats over shallow waters.
A patent? No kidding.
Yeah, making him the only U.S. president to ever hold a patent. While the device was never commercialized, it speaks volumes about his inventive mind and practical problem-solving approach.
That's fascinating.
Let's look at some notable cases that really showcase his unique legal acumen. The Heard v. Rock Island Bridge Company case, for instance.
Okay.
He represented a bridge company against a riverboat company in a landmark dispute involving a canal boat that sank after hitting a bridge. This case highlighted the emerging tensions between established river navigation and the new disruptive railroad infrastructure. Showed his grasp of complex economic and engineering issues.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the incredibly famous William Duff Armstrong murder trial in 1858.
Ah, the Almanac case.
That's the one. A key witness claimed to have seen the crime by moonlight, but Lincoln, with his sharp legal mind and forensic attention to detail, famously used a farmer's almanac to discredit the eyewitness.
How did that work?
Well, he demonstrated that the moon was at such a low angle at the time of the alleged crime that visibility would have been drastically reduced, if not impossible.
Brilliant.
Armstrong was acquitted, cementing Lincoln's reputation as a brilliant trial lawyer. And in another murder case in 1859, the Peachy Quinn Harrison trial, Lincoln successfully argued for the admission of a dying declaration from the victim, which ultimately led to another acquittal.
So really sharp legal skills.
These cases highlight his strategic thinking, his powerful persuasive skills, and his ability to dissect evidence, all of which would become invaluable in his political career.
Lincoln then transitioned fully into the political arena, serving four terms in the Illinois House of Representatives, where he championed significant state projects. How did this experience at the state level serve as a crucible, preparing him for the immense challenges he would face on the national stage?
Well, this raises an important question. How did his state legislative experience inform his later national leadership? During his time in the Illinois House, he was a strong advocate for public improvements. He championed the construction of the Illinois and Michigan Canal, a vital project for the state's economic development.
Connecting the lakes and the river system.
Exactly. Designed to connect the Great Lakes to the Mississippi River system. He also voted to expand suffrage beyond white landowners to all white men, showing an early inclination towards broader democratic participation.
Interesting.
Furthermore, he successfully led the campaign to move the state capital from Vandalia to Springfield, a significant political achievement that required considerable strategic negotiation.
And he gave an important early speech.
Yes. In January 1838, he delivered his Lyceum address in Springfield. In this speech, he indirectly but powerfully attacked Stephen Douglas and the Democratic Party, linking them to mobocracy after the murder of the anti-slavery newspaper editor Elijah Parrish Lovejoy.
So, taking a stand early.
Absolutely. This address was a clear sign of his emerging rhetorical power and his willingness to engage in principled political debate, laying the groundwork for his later national prominence as a powerful orator.
From the state legislature, he even went to Washington, D.C., serving in the U.S. House of Representatives. What kind of impact did he make during his time in the nation's capital?
Indeed, from 1847 to 1849, he served one term. Notably, he was the only Whig in the Illinois delegation, a testament to his political skill in a Democratic-leaning state.
Just one Whig.
The only one from Illinois, then. While there, he teamed with Joshua R. Giddings on a bill to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia, although it ultimately failed to gain sufficient support.
But he tried.
He did. More significantly, he spoke out vehemently against the Mexican-American War. He challenged President Polk with his famous spot resolutions.
The spot resolutions, right. What were those exactly?
He demanded that Polk identify the exact spot on U.S. soil where Mexican soldiers allegedly began the war. This principled stand, questioning the president's actions and the war's justification, well, it cost him political support.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Earned him the derisive nickname Spotty Lincoln in the press. But it demonstrated his unwavering willingness to stand on principle, even when unpopular.
That seems very Lincoln.
It does. He also supported the Wilmot Proviso, a failed but crucial proposal to ban slavery in any new territories acquired from Mexico.
Okay.
Despite these efforts, he declined to run for re-election, having pledged to serve only one term. He then hoped for a federal appointment, which never materialized, and consequently returned to his law practice. But the brewing national storm over slavery would soon call him back to the political stage, irrevocably changing his path and setting him on a course for destiny.
As the country struggled to contain the boiling tensions over slavery, the Compromise of 1850 ultimately failed to calm the national unrest. It just kicked the can down the road, really.
It really did.
Then came the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854. This legislation was a real game changer, effectively overturning earlier agreements and opening up new territories to slavery through popular sovereignty. This act was a pivotal moment for Lincoln, wasn't it? It pulled him back in.
It absolutely was. What's truly fascinating here is how this act ignited Lincoln's political reemergence. He had largely stepped back from direct political campaigning, immersing himself in his successful law practice.
Right.
But the Kansas-Nebraska Act's implications, allowing the expansion of slavery into new territories through local choice, stirred him deeply. Mm-hmm. It struck at the very heart of his moral convictions.
He couldn't stay silent.
No. His powerful Peoria speech in October 1854 explicitly declared his opposition to the expansion of slavery. And this speech marked the beginning of a prolific period where he delivered an estimated 175 speeches over the next 6 years.
175 speeches.
Estimated, yeah. All focused on excluding slavery from the territories. This was a clear signal that he was back in the political fray, not just as a lawyer, but as a committed anti-slavery voice.
And this is when the Republican Party starts forming.
Exactly. The Whig Party, Lincoln's longtime political home, was irreparably split by the Kansas-Nebraska Act and other ineffective efforts to compromise on slavery. This paved the way for the formation of the new Republican Party, established as a northern anti-slavery party fundamentally opposed to the expansion of slavery.
Did Lincoln jump right in?
Interestingly, no. Lincoln initially resisted joining the Republicans. He feared they might become a platform for what he considered extreme abolitionists.
Okay. Cautious.
Yeah. He even declined a state legislature seat in 1854, which would have prevented him from being eligible for the U.S. Senate. He ultimately threw his support to Lyman Trumbull to ensure an anti-slavery voice in the Senate, even if it wasn't his own, demonstrating his strategic priorities.
The Supreme Court's Dred Scott v. Sanford decision in 1857 was another seismic event, wasn't it? It further inflamed tensions and really pushed the nation closer to the brink.
Oh, absolutely. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the Dred Scott decision was indeed a monumental and destructive ruling. Chief Justice Roger B. Taney declared that black people, whether enslaved or free, were not citizens and therefore derived no rights from the Constitution.
Just devastating.
And furthermore, the decision ruled the Missouri Compromise unconstitutional, asserting that Congress could not infringe upon slave owners' property rights by banning slavery in territories.
So it basically opened all territories to slavery.
Effectively, yes. The true insight here is how Dred Scott didn't just uphold slavery. It effectively weaponized the Constitution against the very idea of human equality. It challenged the Declaration of Independence itself and forced Americans to confront whether their nation stood for freedom for all or just for some.
How did Lincoln react?
He denounced it fiercely. He viewed it as a conspiracy of Democrats to support the slave power. He argued powerfully that the decision was at variance with the Declaration of Independence, which stated that all men are created equal with certain unalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
A direct challenge.
Yes, a direct philosophical challenge to the very foundation of the nation, making it impossible to ignore the moral question of slavery.
This clash of ideologies, particularly between Lincoln and Stephen A. Douglas, truly set the stage for his epic 1858 Senate campaign. The debates alone were legendary, becoming a defining moment in American political history. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Absolutely. The 7 Lincoln-Douglas debates held across Illinois in the summer and fall of 1858, they had the atmosphere of a gladiatorial prize fight.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Drawing thousands of eager spectators who traveled miles by wagon, train, and foot just to hear them. Lincoln used this platform to warn that the slave power, the political influence of slaveholding states and interests, was threatening the fundamental values of republicanism and the very notion of popular government. He accused Douglas of distorting the premise that all men are created equal, central to the Declaration.
And Douglas's position.
Douglas, in turn, put forth his Freeport Doctrine. He insisted that despite the Dred Scott decision, local settlers, through popular sovereignty, could still effectively choose whether to allow slavery in their territory by simply not enacting local laws to protect it.
That kind of workaround.
Sort of, yeah. Douglas also relentlessly accused Lincoln of having joined the abolitionists, a radical stance at the time.
The most fierce part of that campaign was Lincoln's speech.
The House divided speech, yes, delivered at the start of his campaign. A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free.
Such powerful imagery.
A stark image of disunion. It became a national rallying cry, a powerful and prophetic encapsulation of the profound crisis facing the country.
Did he win the Senate seat?
No, he didn't. Although Republican legislative candidates won more popular votes across Illinois, the Democrats, due to the way the legislative districts were apportioned, won more seats in the state legislature.
Ah, the legislature chose the senator then.
Exactly. And Douglas was reelected by the legislature. However, Lincoln's eloquent and powerful articulation of the issues during these debates and his direct challenge to Douglas transformed him from a respected prairie lawyer into a leading voice against the expansion of slavery.
So it put him on the map nationally.
Absolutely. It granted him a national political presence and momentum that would prove decisive in the coming years.
Lincoln's Cooper Union speech in New York City in 1860 was another pivotal moment, propelling him decisively onto the national stage and showcasing his intellectual prowess to a critical East Coast audience. It effectively introduced him to the powerful Republican establishment there.
That's a great way to put it. What's truly fascinating here is how Lincoln, who was a relatively unknown figure in the East, masterfully used historical evidence to argue that the Founding Fathers had repeatedly sought to restrict slavery rather than endorse it.
He went deep into the history.
Oh, yeah. He meticulously dissected historical records, rejecting any groping for some middle ground between the right and the wrong. He insisted that morality itself required opposition to slavery's expansion, drawing a clear line in the sand.
And how was he received?
Though he may have appeared awkward in his demeanor and dress, he wasn't exactly a polished Easterner. He demonstrated such profound intellectual leadership and rhetorical skill that he deeply impressed the powerful New York audience. A journalist reported, "No man ever before made such an impression on his first appeal to a New York audience."
High praise.
Very high. The historian David Herbert Donald called it a superb political move for an unannounced presidential aspirant. And his supporters, recognizing his deep connection to his roots, embraced the label the Rail Candidate, using his frontier legend of splitting fence rails to symbolize his humble origins and self-made success.
A powerful image.
Very powerful message for emerging America.
And then the 1860 presidential election itself. It was a chaotic four-way race, and Lincoln's victory was a stark reflection of the country's deep and dangerous divide. It immediately set off alarm bells in the South and signaled that the breaking point was near.
Indeed. Lincoln won the nomination on the third ballot at the Republican National Convention in Chicago, with former Democrat Hannibal Hamlin of Maine as his running mate to balance the ticket.
Four Maine candidates in the general election.
Yes, the election itself was a testament to national polarization. Lincoln, running as the Republican, competed against Stephen Douglas for the Northern Democratic votes, while Southern Democrats nominated John C. Breckinridge. And then a group of former Whigs and Know-Nothings formed the Constitutional Union Party, nominating John Bell.
A real split.
A total split. Lincoln's victory was based almost entirely on support in the North and West. He received no ballots cast for him in 10 Southern slave states.
Not a single vote in 10 states.
Not one recorded. He garnered 1,866,452 votes, representing 39.8% of the total. But this was enough to win the electoral vote decisively.
But that fractured victory.
The fractured victory, with such a stark regional split, prompted a cascade of slave states to begin seceding even before he took office. This raises an important question. How inevitable was conflict after such a deeply divided election result, where a president was elected without a single vote from a significant portion of the country? The stage was now set for the ultimate bloody test of the Union.
Lincoln's election triggered an immediate cascade of events. Slave states began to secede even before he took office in March 1861, forming the Confederate States of America. It truly felt like the nation was unraveling before he even had a chance to lead, a crisis waiting right at his doorstep.
It was immediate. If we connect this to the bigger picture, Lincoln and the Republicans firmly rejected the proposed Crittenden Compromise.
What was that again?
It would have protected slavery in territories south of the Missouri Compromise line and potentially allowed its expansion. Lincoln unequivocally stated, "I will suffer death before I consent to any concession or compromise which looks like buying the privilege to take possession of this government to which we have a constitutional right."
So no compromise on expansion.
No compromise on the core principle of preventing slavery's expansion. That was the Republican platform. But it's also important to note his initial focus on preserving the Union itself. He supported the Corwin Amendment, which would have protected slavery in states where it already existed.
So trying to hold things together initially?
Exactly. It underscores that his paramount goal at this initial stage was indeed preserving the Union, even with slavery intact in those specific areas. But the secession train had already left the station. South Carolina seceded on December 20, 1860, and by February 1, 1861, a wave of southern states, Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, and Texas, had followed suit, forming the Confederate States of America.
His journey to Washington for his inauguration was itself a tale of intrigue and danger, setting a tense, almost foreboding precedent for his presidency.
It really was. He traveled in disguise, evading suspected assassins in Baltimore.
In disguise?
Yeah, he wore a soft felt hat instead of his customary stovepipe hat and draped an overcoat over his shoulders, kind of hunching to conceal his height, all to move through the night unnoticed.
And the press found out.
Well, of course. This secretive journey was mocked by opposition papers, which published caricatures of him sneaking into the Capitol. It clearly demonstrated the intense division and suspicion he faced even before taking the oath of office.
What about his first speech as president?
In his first inaugural address on March 4, 1861, he directly addressed the South, attempting to reassure them. He proclaimed, "I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists." He ended with that powerful poetic appeal to the better angels of our nature, hoping for reconciliation and a peaceful resolution.
But words weren't enough.
No, diplomatic appeals and reassuring words were not enough, and the nation was soon plunged into war.
The attack on Fort Sumter on April 12, 1861, by Confederate forces, finally ignited the Civil War. This pushed Lincoln to make unprecedented decisions, fundamentally altering the role of the presidency in a time of crisis. Okay, let's unpack this. How did he navigate this immediate plunge into conflict?
Well, Lincoln faced an impossible choice regarding Fort Sumter. It was a federal outpost in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina, running low on supplies.
Right.
He consciously chose to send provisions, not reinforcements, just provisions to the fort, knowing full well it might precipitate war, but refusing to surrender the fort and thus concede federal authority.
A calculated risk.
A very calculated risk. And strategically astute, because it rallied the northern public, who now saw military action as necessary to defend the nation's integrity after the Confederates fired first. On April 15th, Lincoln immediately called for 75,000 militiamen, a bold move.
And that forced other states to choose.
Exactly. It forced the remaining border states to choose sides. Tragically, this led to North Carolina, Virginia, Tennessee, and Arkansas seceding, expanding the Confederacy.
And there were problems getting troops to Washington.
Yes. As Union troops moved south through Maryland, Baltimore moms attacked them, and local leaders burned rail bridges to the Capitol, trying to isolate D.C. In response, Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus along the military lines.
Habeas corpus, allowing arrest without trial.
Essentially, yes. Allowing arrest without formal charges or immediate judicial review. A highly controversial and sweeping move for civil liberties, even then.
The suspension of habeas corpus was indeed a highly contentious decision, even challenged by Supreme Court Chief Justice Roger Taney, who believed only Congress had such authority. This was a direct test of the limits of presidential power during wartime.
Absolutely. What's truly fascinating here is Lincoln's assertion of executive power in a crisis, challenging established constitutional norms.
Mm-hmm.
Chief Justice Taney, in Ex parte Merriman, found that only Congress could suspend habeas corpus.
But Lincoln didn't back down.
No, Lincoln engaged in what's called non-acquiescence. He essentially overrode Taney's ruling and persisted with the policy in select areas. Ultimately, an estimated 15,000 civilians were detained without trial during the war.
15,000?
That's the estimate. Some, like the prominent anti-war Democrat Clement L. Vallandigham, were even tried in military courts for treasonable actions, drawing widespread condemnation for attacking free speech and civil liberties.
So a real tension there.
A huge tension. Connecting this to the bigger picture, these actions demonstrated his unwavering willingness to expand presidential war powers, imposing a naval blockade, dispersing funds before congressional appropriation, arresting suspected Confederate sympathizers, all to preserve the Union.
He believed the ends justified the means.
He seemed to believe the very existence of the nation, and thus the Constitution itself, was at stake. He argued that allowing the nation to crumble would be a far greater violation than temporarily suspending certain liberties.
Lincoln didn't just oversee the war. He took incredibly active executive control of it, closely supervising strategy and tactics, and even personally selecting and replacing generals. How did he approach this monumental task of leading a nation in such a brutal conflict?
He had two main priorities from the outset. First, ensuring that Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, was well defended.
Crucial.
Absolutely. And second, waging an aggressive war effort for a prompt, decisive victory. Many northern newspapers, after all, were predicting a victory within 90 days.
That didn't happen.
No, definitely not. He met with his cabinet twice weekly, showing his deep involvement in the day-to-day management of the war. His wife, Mary, occasionally prevailed on him to take carriage rides, concerned about his relentless overwork and the toll the war was taking on him.
He changed his Secretary of War.
Yes. In January 1862, after complaints of inefficiency and profiteering, he replaced Simon Cameron with Edwin Stanton. The two worked so closely that their biographers stated that Stanton and Lincoln virtually conducted the war together.
Wow. What about overall strategy?
Lincoln highly valued General Winfield Scott's Anaconda Plan, which relied on port blockades and advancing down the Mississippi River to sort of strangle the South. He recognized its strategic long-term value. His commitment to defeating the enemy's army, not just capturing territory, was evident in his consistent focus on the strategic importance of locations like Vicksburg.
The international landscape was also incredibly delicate during the war. How did Lincoln manage foreign policy to prevent European intervention, especially when many European leaders might have been tempted to exploit America's weakness and perhaps recognize the Confederacy? That could have been disastrous.
Oh, absolutely disastrous. This raises an important question.
Huh.
How did Lincoln, with his limited familiarity with diplomatic practices, successfully navigate foreign relations on such a complex stage?
Right.
He relied heavily on his combative Secretary of State, William Seward, and worked closely with Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Charles Sumner to persuade European nations, especially Britain and France, not to recognize the Confederacy.
And it worked.
His policy succeeded. All foreign nations remained officially neutral throughout the Civil War, despite some European leaders, like Spain and the Dominican Republic and France and Mexico, looking to exploit U.S. weakness.
Is there a close call?
Yes. A critical moment was the Trent Affair in late 1861. The U.S. Navy illegally seized Confederate envoys from a British mail ship on the high seas. Yet this act of perceived aggression almost sparked war with Britain. But Lincoln defused the crisis by wisely choosing to release the diplomats, prioritizing de-escalation over a diplomatic incident. He didn't want a two-front war.
Smart move.
Very smart. Crucially, the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863 played a significant role in rallying European public opinion to the Union cause by explicitly adding abolition as a war goal. This made it much harder for anti-slavery European powers to support the Confederacy.
Ah, so it had diplomatic impact too.
Definitely. Any real chance of European intervention definitively ended with decisive Union victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg in July 1863. European leaders recognized the Confederate cause was likely doomed to failure.
Lincoln's relationship with his generals was often fraught with frustration, from George McClellan's agonizing slowness to the heavy casualties suffered under Ambrose Burnside and Joseph Hooker. It seemed he was constantly searching for the right military leader to prosecute the war effectively.
Oh, constantly. What's truly illuminating here is Lincoln's relentless, almost desperate search for a fighting general, one who would take decisive action and pursue the enemy.
McClellan wasn't that guy.
He initially appointed George B. McClellan general-in-chief after the Union rout at Bull Run. McClellan was a brilliant organizer, built almost impregnable defenses for Washington. But his slow progress and excessive precautions during his Virginia Peninsula campaign profoundly frustrated Lincoln.
He always thought he was outnumbered.
He seemed to always believe he was outnumbered, delaying crucial engagements. Lincoln eventually removed McClellan, and later Burnside and Hooker, as he sought someone who would engage the enemy aggressively and sustain pressure.
Those were tough losses under Burnside and Hooker.
The defeats at Fredericksburg under Burnside and Chancellorsville under Hooker were particularly demoralizing for the Union cause and for Lincoln personally.
But then came Ulysses S. Grant, a general Lincoln famously recognized and unflinchingly promoted, even in the face of widespread criticism and accusations of drunkenness and high casualties. He saw something in Grant others missed.
He really did. Grant's decisive victories at the Battle of Shiloh and, crucially, in the Vicksburg Campaign, which secured Union control of the Mississippi River, profoundly impressed Lincoln.
That quote about Grant.
Yes, he famously defended Grant against critics by saying, "I can't spare this man. He fights." Following General Meade's failure to effectively capture Lee's army after Gettysburg and Grant's continued success in the West, Lincoln promoted Grant to commander of all Union armies in March 1864.
And Grant changed the strategy.
Under Grant, the Union adopted a more aggressive and sustained strategy of total war. A significant yet often overlooked action during this period was Lincoln signing the Lieber Code in 1863.
The Lieber Code? What was that?
It was a groundbreaking document that governed the Union Army's wartime conduct and defined command responsibility for war crimes and crimes against humanity. It was an early foundational document for international humanitarian law, reflecting a push for a more humane, albeit still brutal, form of warfare.
Interesting.
Grant's bloody overland campaign, though the bloodiest in American history up to that point, was a strategic success. It inflicted proportionately higher casualties on Lee's forces and relentlessly pushed toward Richmond, leading to the eventual siege of Petersburg.
Which eventually led to victory.
Exactly. This relentless pressure culminated in Lincoln visiting the conquered Confederate capital of Richmond in early April 1865, a moment of profound significance.
And there was something about Yosemite.
Yes. Another forward-thinking action, passed amidst the war, was the Yosemite Grant of 1864, signed by Lincoln. It provided unprecedented federal protection for the area we now know as Yosemite National Park. It's seen as an embodiment of the ongoing process of remaking government, and an intentional assertion of a steadfast belief in the eventual Union victory, looking forward to a reunified nation.
While the Civil War raged and consumed most of the nation's attention, the Lincoln administration also grappled with complex Native American affairs, particularly in the West. It's an often overlooked aspect of his wartime presidency, which raises questions about how his principles applied to indigenous populations.
It's a really complex and often tragic area. This raises an important question about how wartime priorities shape policy towards Native Americans, often with devastating outcomes. Lincoln's approach largely focused on assimilation and diminishing tribal landholdings, a policy consistent with many of his predecessors, as the nation pushed westward.
But the war complicated things.
Immensely. His administration struggled to protect Western settlers, railroads, and telegraph lines from Native American attacks amidst the immense demands and resource drain of the Civil War.
There was a specific conflict in Minnesota.
Yes, a notable tragedy, which really tested Lincoln's moral compass, was the Dakota War in Minnesota in August 1862. This horrific conflict was triggered by broken American treaty promises, unfair trading practices by settlers, and the starvation of the Dakota people.
Terrible situation.
Horrific. Hundreds of settlers were killed and 30,000 were displaced from their homes. A subsequent war crimes trial, which legal scholar Carol Chomsky described as a study in military injustice, led to 303 Dakota warriors being sentenced to death.
303.
Yes. Lincoln, in a remarkable act of executive clemency, personally reviewed the cases, sifting through the evidence, and ultimately pardoned all but 39. 38 were ultimately hanged in the largest mass execution in U.S. history.
He personally reviewed the cases.
He did. Took the time amidst everything else.
He famously said, when pressured by a congressman to execute all 303, "I could not afford to hang men for votes." That speaks volumes about his moral compass, even when faced with immense political pressure during a re-election campaign.
Precisely. His moral compass guided his decision, even when it was politically unpopular and could have cost him support. He understood the legal inadequacies of the trials and the broader injustices involved.
Did he try to reform Indian policy?
He called for federal Indian policy reform, prioritizing peaceful administration of Native affairs and condemning encroachment on Native territory. However, these calls for reform and justice, focusing on more humane treatment, didn't really come to fruition until after his death, particularly in response to the horrifying Sand Creek Massacre of 1864. It's a complex part of his legacy, showing his efforts at justice within a broader, often problematic, governmental policy of westward expansion. It highlights the difficult balance he faced, trying to uphold justice while simultaneously managing a national crisis and deeply entrenched societal beliefs.
Lincoln's journey to embracing emancipation as a war aim was gradual and complex, evolving significantly as the war itself progressed. He even initially overrode emancipation orders issued by Union generals, which might surprise some listeners who view him solely as the great emancipator from the outset.
It's a really important point. What's truly fascinating here is his strategic pragmatism at the outset. He initially found emancipation to be outside the general's constitutional power, and he genuinely feared it would push the loyal border states, Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri, to secede and join the Confederacy.
He needed those states.
Desperately. Losing them would have been catastrophic for the Union war effort. However, as the war progressed and became bloodier, the political and moral landscape shifted dramatically.
Congress started acting.
Yes. Congress, in June 1862, passed an act banning slavery in all federal territories, which Lincoln signed. Then, in July, the Confiscation Act of 1862 was enacted. This allowed for the targeted seizure and freeing of slaves belonging to individuals proven disloyal to the United States.
So steps, but not universal emancipation yet.
Exactly. It was a step, but not yet universal. Lincoln reviewed a draft of the proclamation with his cabinet in July 1862, facing criticism from some, like Senator Willard Salisbury Sr., who believed it would light their author to dishonor. Shows the internal pushback he faced even then.
But Horace Greeley, the influential editor of the New York Tribune, famously implored him to act on emancipation in a public letter, challenging him directly. Lincoln's public reply to Greeley explaining his primary goal is iconic and reveals a crucial stage in his evolving thought process.
Indeed, Lincoln's August 22, 1862 letter to Greeley is a crucial document for understanding his strategic mind at that moment. He replied, "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or to destroy slavery."
That famous line?
Yes. "If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that."
So Union first, always.
This statement clearly highlights his primary objective, preserving the Union at all costs. However, it also shows his growing flexibility and willingness to consider emancipation as a military necessity and a means to achieve that ultimate end.
A pragmatic calculation.
The deeper insight here is that while his moral opposition to slavery was clear, his public actions were often guided by a pragmatic calculation of how to best achieve national unity. So, what does this all mean for the proclamation's ultimate impact, moving from a strategic consideration to a revolutionary act?
He issued the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation after the Union victory at Antietam in September 1862, giving the Confederate states a deadline to return to the Union.
Right, a warning shot, basically.
And then the final version on January 1st, 1863. This truly changed the nature of the war, didn't it?
It fundamentally reshaped the conflict. The final version of the Emancipation Proclamation explicitly freed slaves in 10 states in rebellion. Crucially, it exempted those areas under Union control, like the border states, to maintain their loyalty and avoid further fracturing the Union.
And Lincoln felt strongly about signing it.
He commented on signing it, "I never in my life felt more certain that I was doing right than I do in signing this paper." This act profoundly transformed the war from solely a struggle to preserve the Union into a moral crusade against slavery, adding a powerful moral dimension to the Union cause.
And the reaction among Black communities.
On New Year's Eve, 1862, Black people, both enslaved and free, gathered across the United States in emotional watch night ceremonies, looking toward Freedom's Eve and the promised fulfillment of the proclamation. It was a moment of profound hope.
Changed things on the ground, too.
Absolutely. As Union armies advanced south, they now had the explicit objective of freeing thousands from bondage, changing the dynamics and inspiring enslaved people to seek freedom behind Union lines.
But not everyone supported it.
No, definitely not. It was immediately denounced by Copperhead's anti-war Democrats, who saw it as a betrayal of promises to Southern Unionists and an unconstitutional act.
Did it help the war effort militarily?
Yes. It had a direct and immediate military impact. As Lincoln himself noted in a letter to Andrew Johnson, the bare sight of 50,000 armed and drilled Black soldiers on the banks of the Mississippi would end the rebellion at once. It highlighted the strategic value and transformative power of enlisting freedmen into Union ranks. Ultimately, nearly 200,000 Black soldiers would fight for the Union.
The Gettysburg Address, delivered in November 1863 at the dedication of the Battlefield Cemetery, is perhaps the most famous speech in American history. It profoundly redefined the nation's purpose in the midst of its greatest conflict, cementing the ideological stakes of the war.
It's truly remarkable. What's fascinating here is how Lincoln, in just 272 meticulously chosen words, profoundly asserted that the nation was conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
Connecting the war back to the founding ideals.
Exactly. He skillfully linked the immense sacrifice of the brave men who struggled here at Gettysburg to a new birth of freedom, not just for the enslaved, but for the entire nation, ensuring that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Gave the war a higher meaning.
It redefined the Union's cause, not merely as preserving a geographical entity, but as upholding the foundational ideals of human equality and self-governance, giving deeper meaning to the war's immense cost. Following the Union victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, Lincoln also proclaimed a national Thanksgiving holiday to be celebrated on the final Thursday of November, 1863.
Establishing the tradition.
Yes, marking a moment of national gratitude and hope amidst the ongoing brutal war.
While the Emancipation Proclamation was a monumental step, freeing slaves in rebellious states to truly abolish slavery across the entire nation, a constitutional amendment was desperately needed. This was the logical next step for securing freedom permanently.
Absolutely. Lincoln recognized this and significantly increased pressure on Congress for the 13th Amendment.
It didn't pass right away.
No, it initially failed to pass the House in the spring of 1864. But it became a key part of his 1864 re-election platform, making abolition a central issue for the nation's future.
So he ran on it.
He did. After his decisive victory, the second attempt in the House passed on January 31st, 1865, a moment of incredible triumph for abolition, sparking jubilant celebrations in Washington, D.C.
And then it needed ratification.
Yes. After ratification by three-fourths of the states in December 1865, it became the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution, abolishing slavery and involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime.
A permanent change.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it permanently changed the legal and moral fabric of the nation, finally fulfilling in a constitutional sense the promise of equality embedded in the Declaration of Independence and fundamentally reshaping American society.
Running a war of this scale, the largest in American history at that point, required immense and unprecedented funding. How did Lincoln and his Treasury Secretary, Salmon Chase, manage the wartime economy and finance such a colossal undertaking? They essentially had to invent new ways to pay for it.
It's a huge question, and it led to significant innovation. Congress quickly approved Lincoln's request to assemble an army, even increasing his proposed 400,000 soldiers to 500,000. However, both Congress and Chase initially resisted new taxes, preferring loans and tariffs.
But loans weren't enough.
Not after the Union defeat at the First Battle of Bull Run, which caused the bond market to collapse. Congress then passed the Revenue Act of 1861. This act imposed the very first U.S. federal income tax, a flat tax of 3% on annual incomes above $800.
The first income tax?
The first federal one, yes. Mm-hmm. This represented a significant shift towards taxing wealth held in stocks and bonds, rather than just property, as earlier tariffs primarily affected rural areas.
And tariffs went up, too.
Yes. The Morrill Tariff, which had become law just before Lincoln took office, also saw increases under Lincoln. This raised import duties considerably to both increase revenue and support domestic manufacturers by offsetting the burden of new taxes.
The war was incredibly expensive, and these initial revenue measures proved insufficient, so new and often controversial financial innovations were clearly needed. The nation was charting entirely new economic territory.
Indeed. The revenue measures of 1861 proved inadequate, forcing Congress to take further, more radical action. In February 1862, Congress passed the Legal Tender Act.
What did that do?
It authorized the minting of $150 million in greenbacks.
Greenbacks?
Yes. These were revolutionary as they were the first U.S. government banknotes not backed by gold or silver, but rather by the government's promise to honor their value. A national currency, essentially.
Wow. How many were printed?
By war's end, a staggering $450 million worth of greenbacks were in circulation, transforming the nation's currency system. This unprecedented spending contributed to a massive increase in the national debt, which skyrocketed from $65 million in 1860 to over $2 billion by 1866.
$2 billion? That's huge for the time.
Massive. To further fund the war, the Revenue Act of 1862 established an excise tax on nearly every commodity, the first national inheritance tax, and added a progressive tax structure to the federal income tax.
So taxes got more complex.
Much more complex. To manage this entirely new system, Congress created the Office of the Commissioner of Internal Revenue, the precursor to the IRS. A later compromise, the Revenue Act of 1864, set a 5% tax on incomes above $600 and 10% on incomes above $10,000.
How much did income tax contribute?
By the war's end, income tax constituted about one-fifth of federal revenue. Though it was intended as a temporary wartime measure, it signaled a new era of federal financial power.
Beyond taxes and currency, Lincoln's administration also addressed corruption and fostered economic growth through truly forward-thinking legislation, even during the chaos of war. It seems he was not just fighting a war, but also building the foundation for a modern America.
That's a great point. What's truly fascinating here is how, despite the immense demands of the war, transformative economic policies were initiated and passed, reflecting a profound vision for the post-war United States.
Like fighting fraud.
Yes. Lincoln signed the False Claims Act of 1863 to combat wartime fraud, imposing severe penalties and allowing QI-TAM lawsuits by private citizens who could then share in the recovery. A groundbreaking step in fighting government corruption.
And banking reform.
He also established the National Banking Act in 1863 to stabilize the currency and oversee national banks, subject to federal regulation, creating a more unified and secure financial system.
And those famous acts opening up the West.
Crucially, yes.
Yeah.
He passed the Homestead Act of 1862, which made millions of acres of government-held land in the West available at low cost, dramatically encouraging westward migration and settlement by ordinary citizens.
And support for education.
The Morrill Land Grant Colleges Act, also in 1862, provided federal land grants for agricultural and mechanical colleges in each state, laying the foundation for public higher education and practical skills training.
And the railroad.
And the Pacific Railway Acts of 1862 and 1864 granted federal support for the construction of the United States' first transcontinental railroad, completed in 1869, literally stitching the nation together. These acts, passed amidst the greatest national crisis, laid crucial groundwork for westward expansion, economic opportunity, and future national development, demonstrating a profound, almost visionary commitment to America's future. #tag6, the end of a life, the dawn of a new era, 1864-1865.
Lincoln's re-election campaign in 1864 was far from certain, with bloody stalemates on the battlefield and widespread war weariness casting a long shadow over his prospects. Many felt the Union was no closer to victory, making his political survival precarious.
It looked really grim for a while there. This raises an important question. How did Lincoln manage to secure re-election amid such a profound national weariness and political division?
How did he approach it?
He ran under the new National Union Party banner. deliberately selecting War Democrat Andrew Johnson as his running mate to broaden his coalition to include both Republicans and those Democrats who supported the war effort.
Did Republicans think he could win?
Initially, many Republicans feared defeat due to the grim military situation, with Grant's bloody overland campaign stalling and Confederate victories like the Battle of the Crater causing despair. Lincoln himself was pessimistic for a time.
Really? He thought he might lose.
Yes. He even prepared a confidential memorandum pledging that if he were to lose the election, he would cooperate with the president-elect as to save the Union between the election and the inauguration. It shows his profound commitment to the nation above his own political fate.
But things turned around.
Yes. Crucial Union victories, particularly General Sherman's capture of Atlanta in September and General Sheridan's successes in the Shenandoah Valley in October, dramatically turned public opinion in his favor.
Changed the narrative.
Completely. It shifted the perception of inevitable defeat to the promise of victory, leading to his reelection. His second inauguration marked a pivotal moment, a testament to his resilience and the nation's enduring hope.
His second inaugural address in March 1865, just a month before the war's end, is widely considered a masterpiece. It wasn't a victory speech, but a profound vision for national healing and reconciliation that transcends its historical moment, speaking to universal ideals.
It's truly considered among the small handful of semi-sacred texts by which Americans conceive their place in the world. Its words are famously inscribed in the Lincoln Memorial.
What was its core message?
In this address, Lincoln sought to interpret the meaning of the war through a moral and theological lens and to lay out a path for the future. He famously attributed the war to God's will, a divine punishment for the sin of slavery shared by both North and South.
And the ending.
The ending resonates with timeless power and humanity, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right. Let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds.
Beautiful words.
To care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. It was a call for magnanimity and unity, not vengeance.
And soon after, the war ended.
Just over a month later, Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox, signaling the definitive end of the war and the beginning of the daunting task of Reconstruction.
With the war finally ending, Lincoln immediately turned his focus to the immense challenge of Reconstruction. How did he envision reuniting a war-torn nation, particularly with the defeated Confederates and the millions of newly freed slaves? What was his philosophy for binding up the nation's wounds?
What's truly fascinating here is his incredibly magnanimous approach. When a general asked Lincoln how the defeated Confederates should be treated, Lincoln simply replied, "Let him up easy."
Let him up easy.
Yeah. He was focused not on blame or retribution, but on the urgent task of rebuilding and reuniting the nation, and crucially, avoiding further alienating the South. His amnesty proclamation of December 8, 1863, offered generous pardons to most who would sign an oath of allegiance, with specific exceptions for high-ranking Confederate officials.
So he was more moderate than some in Congress.
Definitely. Lincoln led the moderate wing of Reconstruction policy, often clashing with the more radical Republicans in Congress, like Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner. They sought harsher terms for the South and greater protections for freed slaves.
What was his plan?
He proposed a 10% plan for states like Louisiana, where statehood could be reestablished if just 10% of the 1860 voters took the oath of allegiance and agreed to abolish slavery.
And the radicals opposed that.
Yes. The radicals deemed this far too lenient. They opposed it and famously pocket vetoed the Wade-Davis bill, their own more stringent plan that Lincoln refused to sign.
What about support for the formerly enslaved?
Lincoln did sign the Freedmen's Bureau bill. This acknowledged government responsibility for the material needs of former slaves, things like food, shelter, education, and legal help. But it fell short of the 40 acres and a mule that many freedmen hoped for from confiscated Confederate property.
Was his thinking evolving on things like voting rights?
That's a key debate. Historian Eric Foner argues Lincoln did not initially envision a sweeping social revolution beyond emancipation itself. However, scholar Philip Paludan suggests Lincoln may have been moving towards more radical positions, particularly regarding black suffrage, just before his death. It shows an evolving understanding of post-slavery America.
Just days after Lee's surrender, as the nation was celebrating peace and anticipating reunion, it suffered another profound loss: Abraham Lincoln's tragic assassination. Here's where it gets really interesting, or rather incredibly tragic. This event, so close to victory, irrevocably altered the course of American history.
It's just an incredibly poignant and devastating moment in history. On April 11, 1865, in his very last public address, Lincoln stated his preference for conferring the franchise, the right to vote, on some black men, specifically on the very intelligent and on those who serve our cause as soldiers.
Advocating for black suffrage, even limited.
Yes. And this statement, advocating for even limited black suffrage, proved to be a catalyst for tragedy. Confederate sympathizer John Wilkes Booth, a well-known actor and ardent white supremacist who believed Lincoln was an oppressor of the South, was present at that address. Yeah. He was spurred to plot his assassination, seeing Lincoln as a tyrant who sought to elevate black Americans.
So Booth heard that speech.
He heard it and reportedly said, "That means nigger citizenship. Now, by God, I'll put him through. That is the last speech he will ever make."
Chilling.
On April 14th, 1865, a solemn Good Friday, Lincoln and his wife attended the play, Our American Cousin, at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. General Ulysses S. Grant was also supposed to attend, but, fatefully, decided to visit his children in New Jersey at the last minute.
Grant wasn't there.
No. At around 10:03 p.m., Booth, familiar with the theater and its layout, slipped into Lincoln's private theater box, crept up from behind, and fired a single-shot Derringer at the back of Lincoln's head, mortally wounding him.
Oh, my God.
Lincoln's guest, Major Henry Rathbone, briefly grappled with Booth, but Booth stabbed him with a knife and then famously leaped from the box to the stage, shouting, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus always to tyrants, before escaping into the night.
He escaped.
Initially, yes. Lincoln was immediately attended to by doctors and then carried across the street to Peterson House, a boarding house. He remained in a coma for 9 hours, dying at 7:22 a.m. on April 15th.
The nation must have been stunned.
Plunged into deep collective mourning, a sudden shift from the jubilation of war's end to profound grief, Andrew Johnson was sworn in as president later that day.
What happened to Booth?
Booth was located, shot, and killed 2 weeks later in a barn in Virginia, bringing an end to the manhunt.
And the nation mourned Lincoln.
Immensely. Lincoln's body lay in state, first at the White House and then in the Capitol Rotunda, followed by a 2-week funeral train journey from Washington, D.C. to Springfield, Illinois. Hundreds of thousands mourned, gathering along the tracks in silent grief or with music, a nation united in sorrow. The poet Walt Whitman, deeply moved, composed elegies like, "O Captain, My Captain," to honor the fallen president, forever cementing his place in American memory.
Lincoln's political philosophy profoundly redefined American republicanism, connecting it deeply and inextricably to the principles enshrined in the Declaration of Independence, especially that radical concept of equality.
He really did. He called the Declaration's unalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness the sheet anchor of republicanism, the foundational principle upon which the nation was truly built.
Shifting the focus from just the Constitution.
Exactly. This was a significant philosophical shift, moving the focus from the Constitution as the sole foundation of the nation to emphasizing equality as a foundational guiding principle. This reinterpretation had a monumental impact on social and political movements well into the 20th century.
What about his earlier political leanings?
As a Whig activist early in his career, Lincoln was a spokesman for business interests. He favored high tariffs, national banks, infrastructure improvements, railroads, opposing the Jacksonian Democrats' emphasis on agrarianism and limited government.
But he admired Jackson in some ways.
Yes, he admired Andrew Jackson's steeliness and patriotism, adopting the Jacksonian belief in the common man, while his reverence for the founding fathers, the Constitution, and the preservation of the Republic formed his conservatism. His policies were undeniably transformative and progressive for their time.
And what about his religious beliefs? They seem to have evolved significantly throughout his life, presenting a bit of a puzzle to historians, almost a personal spiritual journey amidst the national turmoil.
It's a fascinating area. This truly raises an important question. Was Lincoln a religious skeptic or a deeply devout man? As a young man, he was indeed a religious skeptic and subscribed to the doctrine of necessity.
Doctrine of necessity?
Yeah, a belief that all human actions are predetermined by external forces or God's will, meaning free choice, is an illusion. This philosophical stance could profoundly shape his view on destiny and the immense struggles he faced.
But he used the Bible a lot.
Oh, he was deeply familiar with the Bible and frequently quoted scripture in his public speeches, including his three most famous, the House Divided speech, the Gettysburg Address, and his second inaugural address.
Did grief change his views?
It seems so. After the death of his son Edward in 1850, and especially Willie in 1862, he expressed more dependence on God, seemingly finding solace and meaning in faith during profound personal grief and national suffering.
Did he join a church?
No, he never formally joined a church, but frequently attended Presbyterian services, both in Springfield and in Washington, D.C. It's complicated because accounts differ. His law partner, William Herndon, called him an unbeliever after his death.
Really?
But his pastor, James Smith, asserted his belief in divine authority and the inspiration of the scriptures. Ultimately, the inner Lincoln remains a puzzle, leaving us with differing accounts. It suggests a complex, evolving, and deeply personal faith.
And his last words?
His wife even reported his last words as, "There is no place I so much desire to see as Jerusalem," indicating perhaps a deep spiritual longing at the end.
Beyond his political genius and complex inner life, Lincoln was also a striking physical presence, a figure that truly stood out in any crowd, often described in vivid, sometimes unflattering terms.
He certainly was. He was a slender 6 feet 4 inches tall, an imposing and distinctive figure. As a youth, he was described as awkward and gawky, but also remarkably strong, participated enthusiastically in jumping, throwing, wrestling, foot races.
And the beard came later.
Famously, yes. He didn't grow his beard until 1860, apparently at the suggestion of an 11-year-old girl named Grace Bedell, became the first U.S. president to do so, and forever changing his iconic image.
How did people describe his looks?
His law partner, William Herndon, described his face as long, narrow, sallow, and cadaverous, with leathery and saffron-colored cheeks. Detractors were not kind. The Charleston Mercury called him the dirtiest complexion.
Ouch.
Yeah. He also apparently cared little about fashion, often exposing 6 inches of his shin between his socks and pants.
So maybe not a fashion icon.
Definitely not the most fashion-forward president, but perhaps his mind was on other more important things.
And he also battled several illnesses throughout his life, another aspect that adds to the very human dimension of this historical giant, reminding us of the immense physical and mental burdens he carried.
He did. He suffered from clinical depression, or melancholy as it was known then, which deeply affected him throughout his life, sometimes incapacitating him.
And other illnesses.
He also experienced smallpox and malaria, diseases that were common and often deadly at the time.
Hmm.
Interestingly, he took mercury containing blue mass pills to treat his melancholy.
Mercury pills.
Yes, which some speculate may have led to mercury poisoning, further exacerbating some of his physical symptoms like mood swings or insomnia.
Did his health decline towards the end?
Photographs from before his assassination appear to show significant weight loss and facial changes, leading to speculation among historians and medical professionals about declining health. Some have even proposed that he could have had a rare genetic disorder such as Marfan syndrome or multiple endocrine neoplasia type 2B, though this remains speculative and unconfirmed.
So carrying immense burdens, physically and mentally.
Absolutely. These physical and mental health struggles highlight the immense burdens he carried, not just as president, but as a man constantly confronting personal and national tragedy.
Lincoln's assassination cemented his place as a national martyr. But his legacy has been interpreted and reinterpreted in many ways over time, reflecting shifting societal values and ongoing political debates. It's not a static image, is it?
Not at all. If we connect this to the bigger picture, abolitionists immediately viewed him as a champion of human liberty, transforming him into a martyr for the cause. By the progressive era, he was one of America's most venerated heroes, even among some white Southerners who admired his vision for unity.
Did that change later?
His symbolic power, however, somewhat faded after World War II, maybe becoming more complex. Throughout history, he's been claimed by both liberals, who see him as an advocate of the common man and an architect of a more active government, and conservatives, who admire his nationalism, support for business, and devotion to the Founding Fathers' principles.
What did Frederick Douglass think?
Frederick Douglass, the eminent black orator and former slave, offered profound praise, stating that in Lincoln's company, I was never reminded of my humble origin or of my unpopular color. High praise indeed.
But there have been criticisms too.
Yes. By the late 1960s, some black intellectuals, like Lerone Bennett Jr. in his controversial book Forced into Glory, called him a white supremacist. They cited his use of ethnic slurs, which were common then but jarring now, and his stated opposition to social equality, particularly his early support for the colonization of freed slaves outside the U.S.
How did defenders respond?
Defenders, in turn, attribute these aspects to political necessity and the prevailing societal views of the time, rather than his true personal beliefs or his actions on emancipation and the 13th Amendment. This raises an important question. How do we reconcile the complex figure of Lincoln with his monumental achievements, his sometimes contradictory words and actions, and our evolving understanding of racial justice?
It's a continuing conversation.
Absolutely. He's also been widely portrayed as a folk hero, Honest Abe, and Hollywood has often depicted him in a flattering light. Globally, figures like Karl Marx, Mahatma Gandhi, and Nelson Mandela have admired him. Mandela even likened Lincoln's new birth of freedom to the end of apartheid in South Africa. Shows his enduring global resonance as a symbol of liberation.
His image is everywhere, etched into our national identity, and a constant visible reminder of his enduring impact, almost omnipresent in American life.
Absolutely. Lincoln's portrait appears on two denominations of United States currency, the penny and the $5 bill.
Instantly recognizable.
He's featured on postage stamps worldwide. He's memorialized in countless towns, city, and county names, including the capital of Nebraska. The U.S. Navy has named three vessels after him, including the Nimitz-class aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln, CVN-72.
And the big memorials.
The Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. is one of the most visited National Park Service sites in the country, a place of quiet reflection and powerful symbolism. His home and tomb are preserved in Springfield, Illinois. His image is carved into the stone of Mount Rushmore, and Augustus St. Gaudens' iconic statue of Lincoln stands in Lincoln Park, Chicago, with diplomatic recastings in London and Mexico City.
So a global presence.
These memorials reflect his enduring presence in American memory and his global recognition as a symbol of freedom, unity, and courageous leadership.
We've taken a deep dive into the extraordinary life of Abraham Lincoln, from his humble birth in that log cabin to his pivotal role in preserving the Union and ultimately abolishing slavery. His story is one of profound personal challenge, immense intellectual growth, and unparalleled national leadership during a time of existential crisis. So what does this all mean for us today in our own complex world?
Well, Lincoln's journey reminds us that leadership during crisis often requires uncomfortable compromises, difficult decisions, and an unwavering, often lonely commitment to a higher ideal. His emphasis on malice toward none with charity for all remains a powerful aspiration for national healing and unity, even, or maybe especially, in our own divided times.
A lesson still relevant.
It's a call to bridge, divides, and focus on shared purpose, even after immense conflict. Consider his words from the Gettysburg Address. Government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. How might his vision for national unity and the persistent, if sometimes imperfect, pursuit of equality guide us in addressing the challenges we face today? And maybe more personally, what sacrifices are we willing to make for those better angels of our nature to prevail?
A truly powerful thought to consider. We encourage you to explore more about Lincoln, perhaps by reading his powerful speeches, delving into one of the many fantastic biographies about him, or even visiting the numerous memorials dedicated to his enduring legacy.